Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July the 26th, 1999, and in the Quinnia Fireside Room this afternoon are Mary and Roy Nielsen, session called Created in the Divine Image, What is My Potential? Number 99-1. Let's listen in.
So every day, we'll just do a little review of what we did the day before and then go off into different kind of material. So you can come and go as you please. You won't hear much repetition from day to day because it's that complicated. that's the way we're going to do it. Are we ready to start, do you think?
Yep.
Okay, we're almost... Okay, roll the tape. This I was told to do. This is Created in the Divine Image, Enneagram Lecture Number 1 by Roy and Mary Nielsen. Because we like to center everything in scripture and in prayer, I would like to begin by reading to you from 1 Corinthians. Is a wonderful text, and it's a wonderful text for what we're going to be talking about today. 1 Corinthians 12. Now there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. And there are varieties of services, but the same Lord. And there are varieties of activities, but it is the same God who activates all of them in everyone. To each is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. Shall we pray? Gracious giver of good gifts, we thank you for all these people who have gathered to explore themselves, to discover their gifts, to use them for the common good. We thank you for the gifts you have given to each of us. We thank you for our using them even when we weren't aware that they were our very special gift. May we now, in light of this new information, claim and live and breathe and nurture that particular gift in a more wonderful and whole and real way. We ask this all in your name. Amen.
Amen.
Okay. Let me ask again, how many of you know anything at all about the Enneagram? Hands. Few here? Okay. How many of you know anything at all about Myers-Briggs? Quite a few. Okay. So you know something about personality typing systems and ways of looking at people and the whole notion that there are fundamental real differences in human beings, that we come into the world pretty hardwired to be different from each other in particular ways. For those of you who know something about the Myers-Briggs, I thought it might be interesting to just compare Enneagram with Myers-Briggs so you get a little sense of what we're talking about and where we're going here. The Myers-Briggs is a very careful and very studied lens that records the way we interface with the world. So are we introverts or extroverts? Are we sensing or intuitive? Are we thinking or feeling? Are we judging or perceiving? How do we act in the world? How do others feel us? How are we shaped in the world? The Enneagram, on the other hand, is a very careful lens that records what happens within us, what all the little games we play with ourselves and the defenses and the interfaces that go on inside. And so it's a kind of a Myers-Briggs looks out, Enneagram kind of looks in. The Myers-Briggs is based on an assumption that I'm okay, you're okay. You know, you discover your type and oh yeah, gee, wow, that's great. The Enneagram is based on the assumption that it's a whole lot more complicated than that. Yes, there is something in me that's wonderful, but there's also something in me that is not very wonderful at all. And it's a pretty bitter pill to have to swallow. Just FYI, it took me a year to face up to my type. Major defense system in place to avoid that one. The Myers-Briggs names what I am. The Enneagram names what I can be. It shows us what we can be, both good and bad. It gives us the trajectory for all of our potential as a human being in a particular way. Because of that, many people, including my husband and I, who are both trained spiritual directors, have found that the Enneagram is a much more powerful tool in spiritual direction, in spiritual formation, in helping people in spiritual transformation and so on, because it shows a path. It gives you a sense of what I can be when I'm being all I can be. And that's a pretty wonderful thing. It also, when you link it to Christianity, which it doesn't necessarily have to be linked to, when you link it to Christianity, you also have the wonderful grace of a God who forgives us when we fail and who gives us the Spirit to help us to find ourselves and to face the truth and to live to our wholeness. So that's what we're going to be talking about this week. You might want to ask if it is a bitter pill, if it is hard, if it is difficult to face this sort of darker side of who we are, why should we have to do that? And I think the only good answer to that is that in many ways the truth will set us free. And the truth is, in one sense, Jesus Christ who sets us free. It also is, in another sense, an honest assessment of ourself that can set us free. A good analogy in one sense, and I hope this is a helpful analogy for you, but it's a little bit like when you finally name your type and say, yes, this is who I am. It's a little bit like what happens for an alcoholic when they finally are able to say, my name is Jim, I'm an alcoholic. It's like, wow, I've said it. This is who I am. Now my recovery can start. Now I've named that kind of dark side. Now there's a chance that I can move on. And that's kind of what the Enneagram is like. And that's why it's really worth doing. Now, we will probably end up talking like all of this is fact and truth with a capital T and that sort of thing. Trust us when we say we know that isn't true. This is theory. We know that God is mystery, finally, that human beings are finally mystery. But still, there are theories that are much more useful than other theories. And as a theory, this is a really, I think, a very useful theory. You know, if you just know that, just know that we know that this is theory. And the theory is grounded in the notion that human beings come into the world hardwired in a particular way, in a way that is not changeable. In other words, that you're born a type. That's what most of the theorists say, that you're born a type, and that you respond to things after that according to your type. So with that kind of little bit of basic information, I want to talk about one way of looking at this theory, which I think is wonderful and helpful. And that has to do with just the idea of being created in the divine image. And we know that from Genesis, that we are created in the divine image. So if you can visualize God out there, this big presence encompassing everything, and that there are many facets of God. There are probably many more than nine, but we've kind of summarized them as nine facets of God. And that each of us is born into the world to reflect into human society clearly and beautifully and distinctly one of those facets. We don't have to be God. We don't have to do it all. We have each other to help. But we are given one pure, beautiful gift, which is a reflection of the divine. And that's what our job is, our role, our gift, our challenge, our purpose in human society. So the type that we call ones come into the world with an eye, with a peculiar, wonderful lens that sees the whole, that sees completion, that sees the ideal, the vision of the ideal. And the vision of the ideal is of justice and mercy combined. So it is the wonderful facet of God, which is the facet of justice and mercy, that ones are given to reflect into the world and to be the particular reflectors into the world. That's what their eye is. That's what their desire is, their passion is to bring justice, wholeness, vision into the world. The people we call twos are people who have been given the particular facet of God that we call caring or compassion. The God that mends our wounds. The God that lifts the child up and sets the child on his lap, as we can picture Jesus doing. The God that weeps when his friend dies. That God that cares, that loves, that knows what we need even before we know, and that can somehow work to meet those needs. And these people, these twos, have been given that incredible image, facet of God to reflect into human life. And human life is so much richer for it, because where would we be without people who cared, who took care of things, who saw what other people needed, who really loved and wanted to respond to that need? Threes are given are the reflection of the God of hope. And hope is, in some ways, I remember a sermon my husband preached at one point where it was a quote by whom?
I don't remember the quote. Oh. which sermon?
The hope quote. Hope is the unquiet heart.
Who
is that? I can't remember. Anyway, doesn't matter. Hope is the unquiet heart. So, a heart that is hopeful is a heart that believes that things can be better. You see? And so the gift of hope is also linked with the gift of enterprising or producing or making or doing. It is only when we believe that that something is going to make a difference, or that it's possible to do something, that we do it, right? So people who are given this wonderful gift of hope are the doers in the world. The people that just walk into a room and see what needs to be done, and they do it. The people that see that a bridge needs to be built, so they build it. The people that make things I mean, it's just incredible how the American culture has been built basically with three energy. I mean, they've said that American culture up to the baby boomers was a three culture, a can-do culture. If it needs to be done, if it can be done, we can do it. You need to dam a river? Yeah, we'll build a dam. Sure, we can do that. Skyscraper? We can build it. That kind of doing, enterprising, it comes out of and flows out of this reflection of the God of hope, that things can change, that things can be done. Some people, the fours, reflect a God that is unique, that is one, that is singular, that is of a kind. And These people bring that singularity into the world, and their gift is to be creative, to be unique, to be one of a kind. I know there are chairs over here. Yeah, that's fine. And they have that vision of the singularity of things, of the one-of-a-kindness of things. And that's their particular gift to human life. Fives reflect the omniscient, all-knowing God, the God who knows things even before we know things. So fives are the people who collect knowledge, who just want to know things, to just be a knowing person. And that's the reflection of the omniscient, all-knowing God into human society. Sixes are born with this wonderful gift of fidelity or faithfulness. These are the people who understand that God is a faithful God. God does not leave us destitute. God does not desert God's people. That God is faithful and loving and abiding. And these sixes bring that wonderful gift into human life, the gift of faithfulness, of abidingness, of sticking with it, of just hanging in there, being faithful. Sevens reflect the wonderful joy and delight of God, manifested in the Genesis text where the creation is complete and God looked at it and God said, yeah, wow, this is good. Yes. The Jesus that likes to have a party, that makes wine, that, you know, gets called, he's criticized for being too raucous and for hanging out with sinners and so on. The joy of God. And sevens bring that wonderful sense of delight and joy and energy into the world. Eights are the people who reflect the power of God, the omnipotence of God, the God that can do things, that can be in charge, that can lead, that can take action, the powerful God, the God that in Old Testament texts is often feared, but also often needed and called upon to help. That's the gift of the eight. The nines are given the gift of love, the gift of peace, the gift of contentment, of harmony, that wonderful, the peace I give you, not as the world gives it to you, I give you the peace that passes all understanding. That is the gift of the nine, that the nines bring into human society. And you know when a nine it walks in the room because everything just kind of settles down and people feel better. You know when an eight walks in the room because all of a sudden there's sort of a power ripple through the room. And when a seven walks in the room, everything kind of goes like this. So those are the gifts that each of these types have been given. And all of that is designed to reflect into human life. And when all of these people are present and all of these people are reflecting clearly and purely and brightly, we have what? Heaven. Utopia, something that we've never experienced, you see. Because the fact is, what has happened? What has happened?
God is being reflected. All of God.
God can be reflected. And yet we all know that most of the time, most of our lives, we're like those funny mirrors in a funny you know, at a circus where you go in, or you stand in front of the mirror and you're all rippled, or you're big and fat, or you're teeny and skinny, or, I mean, we do something weird to the reflection. We distort it in some way. And that distortion happens because all of us, nobody gets into this life without being wounded. And you can call that wound original sin, you can call it the original woundedness, you can call it, if you're a Buddhist, karma, you can call it, if you're a behaviorist, mother abandonment, call it what you will. The fact is, we all end up being wounded. And that somehow, because of that wound, we start to wrap ourselves in ourselves. We take the gift that we have been given and we use it instead of letting it reflect out into the world, it be in the world. We use it to protect ourselves because we hurt. I like to think that original wound comes at the time of birth, when we're forced in a very painful process from the most perfect place we will ever live into a very cold and harsh and inhospitable world. That somehow that process jars us all in some way, and we never quite recover from it. Other people say it differently. That's just kind of the way I think about it. So that what tends to happen is that these ones who've been given this incredible gift of justice and of mercy to reflect into the world, that part of them is wounded. The thrusting forth of through the birth canal causes a kind of sense of abandonment or rejection of some sort. And they realize they have to build up a defense against the pain of the world. And the defense that they build up becomes what in Freudian language is called the ego. Or I think the personality would be another word for it. It's what we present to the world. And it covers up our real essence. It protects it. And it's absolutely essential that we do that. We could not live without doing that. We're not bad people for covering up the gift that God has given us. It's absolutely essential. We could not survive in the world if we didn't. But what happens is that this wonderful gift of justice, of completion, of wholeness, in the self-made protective device becomes instead a kind of needing to be right, or being right, of being in control, of being good, of being perfect. These people become the perfectionists of the world, the people that are just driven to be perfect in whatever they do. And that's their little wall around themselves that protects that precious gift on the inside that was so hurt. And so we butt up against the wall. The wall is what we see. And the wall is this kind of little bit critical, a little bit orderly. If you want a good proofreader for a copy, you get a one every time. You know, if you want somebody to balance your checkbook, get a one. Because they do things accurately and carefully and precisely and well. But that's the outside. These wonderful twos who were given this delightful gift of caring in the world, of being loving, of being charitable, of being altruistic in their giving, become caretakers. They are just out there taking care of you whether you want to be taken care of or not. You know, they know exactly what you need and they'll give it to you whether you need it or not. They just have an instinct for, and they come at you like this, do you see? And you may be all, maybe you are those people, maybe you know people like that. It's very nice to have a two in your life for a while. but an unhealthy two can get very controlling, very manipulative. It becomes the Jewish mama syndrome, the sort of caricature of the after all I've done for you kind of thing. Their instinct for knowing what other people need gets hurt. That beautiful gift from God gets hurt, and they cover it up with a kind of, I know what you need, and I'm going to help you. And so that's what they do. These threes who have this wonderful gift of hope that just infuses every part of them, and it gives them an eye for what can be done, cover that up. And instead, they become people with an eye for how they can be successful. And they become often success-driven people. And that kind of ladder climbing or success-driven up the corporate ladder, that sort of energy is what this self-made wall that threes build to protect themselves from the wound that they receive at the point of their gift. These dear fours who are, John, do you want to talk about fours? No.
Very special.
Yes, they like to think they're very special.
I believe it.
Yeah. They've been given this quality of uniqueness, of ability to create. And it's true and it's real. And yet, they're wounded at that point, and what they cover themselves up with is a false sense of their own uniqueness. So they dress uniquely. Whatever they do, they get attention because they need to be unique in what they're doing. Fives. These people who are given this incredible gift of knowing become the people who just hoard knowledge, who never know enough, who can't get the book written, who can't get their work out there, who knowledge for the sake of knowledge, and it all comes in and comes in and comes in, and they feel no responsibility for using it, for getting it out there. They present themselves as what's a nice way of saying it, those of you who are in academia?
Experts.
Yeah. And they'll always sort of direct the conversation to their area of expertise. And so you always know what they know, but the knowing is not, there's not a sense of the knowing as a gift for the common good. The wall prevents that from happening. These wonderful sixes who have been given this great reflector to reflect faithfulness into the world, they get hurt. They discover the world is not a trustworthy place. And so instead of this gift of faithfulness, they become dutiful and responsible and cooperative. They become the troopers, the loyalists, the people that work within institutions. Sometimes they become the people who butt up against institutions. But whatever it is, they're in there. They're being faithful, but often with a kind of angry or resentful, sarcastic tone to it. Sevens, these people who, this is what I am, by the way, so what I had to finally admit about myself, admit that I was a materialistic, shallow, superficial glutton. It was hard, trust me. But we all know the difference between true joy and happiness, fun. And sevens cover up their true joy because they were wounded there. And they cover it up with this mask, with this self-made mask that mimics joy, but it's fun. It's kind of, come on, let's go, like that kind of energy. The fun, the happy, the optimistic, the that kind of energy that drives a lot of people like it, and it drives a lot of people nuts. So
drives me nuts.
Yes.
But you're faithful.
But I'm faithful. 40 years.
Yes. I have to tell a story. We have this son who, well, we have a bunch of kids who think that it's their right to ask probing questions of their parents every time we get together. So this time, we were sitting around. It was, I think, New Year's Eve, wasn't it? And they'd gotten the kids to bed, and the lights were low, and we were just sitting around with a glass of wine and some soft music. And the lead question was, well, Dad, tell me why you've been faithful to Mom.
To which my response was,
well, no, just wait a minute. As a
she
seven,
always embellishes stories.
Well, of course, but they need to know what I wanted.
Oh, yes, of course.
In order to make your response seem all the more heartless and cruel. What I assumed he would say and what I wanted him to say was, of course, I've been faithful to her because she is so wonderful. She is so incredible. She is so sensuous. She is so delightful. She is just anything a man would ever want. How could I ever even consider anybody else? Because she is so incredible.
She is so hyperbolic.
Yes. What he said was, because I believe in a faithful God.
Oh.
Yeah.
Now, if I had been in her position and she had responded that way, I would have been as mad as...
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I understand where she's coming from.
Okay, where are we here? I can't remember.
You're going to eat.
It's your responsibility to tell me where I am when I get lost.
Okay. You're going to
eat.
You're at eight.
I think we've done enough on seven. Quite enough. Eights. These people that have been given the amazing, omnipotent image of God to reflect into the world. People who, for whom the power is used magnanimously and in heroic, courageous ways. They become instead the people who use power over instead of power to. They become the tough guys. It's the same, you know, they're wounded somehow at that point of power. And it's the same, it's power, but it's a different kind of power that comes out of them. And that's what happens to AIDS. They like to present themselves as invincible in some way. These nines who are given this incredible peace that passes all understanding image of God. And they're just these wonderful people, are wounded at that point, and create the self around them that is agreeable. And so they're always nice. They're always agreeable. You want to go to a show? Sure, that's fine. Well, why don't we stay home instead? Okay, that's okay. What do you want to do? Well, I don't care, whatever you want to do. that's the way nines can be, that their self-image is developed so that they, because they want to be agreeable, and they want the world to see them as agreeable. They've lost the pureness of the joy. We found a nine in their lives.
Like
already we know that.
Things go much more smoothly.
Yeah. Well, nines are
don't
great
tell
to have
them how to
I would wish you all nine children because...
Would his tail all of them?
Yeah. And we are all a little bit all of them, of course, because we pick up the reflected rays all over the place. And tomorrow when we get into the Enneagram symbol, you'll see how we can pick up some rays more than others and how that works and when it works. But the idea of Enneagram, the theory of Enneagram, is that there is one particular and special facet of God that we have been created to reflect into the world. And that whatever we can do, and whatever God can do through us, to help us clean up that mirror that gets dirty and smudged and out of sorts and out of shape, we need to do. Because then we can more clearly reflect that facet of God into human life and into our human society. How are we doing for time? Why don't I take a minute now to ask if there are any questions at this point? All of Enneagram is oral tradition, so we need...
When this week's over, will we be able to recognize who we are, the one, what we are?
Well, if you're more courageous than I am. I'll give you the tools.
Okay.
Is there any propensity towards male, female, or gender?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because there are a couple of types. I mean, almost all men are eight wannabes. You know, they want to be the macho guy, the guy. I mean, our culture is just infused with that image of maleness, of being eight. Our son always talks about how we have a 9 son and an 8 son, and the 9 son always talks about how he's an 8 wannabe. He would love to be an 8. Well, you don't, the fact that you want to be something means that you don't understand what it is to be it, because you don't understand the curse under it, you know, that makes it hard to be that. And 2s are considered the feminine, a more feminine, caring, nurturing kind of type. So you would think that might be true. But the person we studied under at Loyola University, Jerry Wagner, spent his whole 20 years of adult research life studying gender in relationship to Enneagram, and assuming he would have this wonderful book to write that would prove something. And he can't find a correlation. Tiny slant of more men as a tiny slant of more women as 2, no slant anywhere else. So it seems as though this is something that's under gender, that it's deeper than gender, which is really interesting. What is interesting is how hard it is for 8s to admit, 8 women to admit their 8s, and for 2 men to admit their 2s. One of the inventories, I'm trained to do an interview to help people figure out what they are. And we were doing all the youth workers, our youth group at our church has been just doing this Enneagram stuff. And I interviewed all the youth workers so they would know, you know, have some sense of who they were so they could be more agile in the discussion. And one of these men, I couldn't figure out. I just couldn't figure out. And it took me the longest time. And finally figured out he was a 2. But the reason it was so hard for me, I'm trained to listen to language because I'm a writer, and so I listen to language. And he had washed all of the helping language out of his system. He was a businessman. He was a guy. He had to be tough, and he never spoke any of the flag words that you listen to, like, oh, I just feel, I just felt so bad for her, or I just, you know, that kind of thing. None of the language was anywhere in his language system, because it wasn't guy language. And so, you know, that's kind of interesting. One of the funny, I think funny things in this inventory, it tells the percentage of people who think they're something who really aren't. And there's on every page, there's a little graph here somewhere. Well, maybe there isn't. there was somewhere. But the eight, what is it like? 80% of men or something think that they're eights, and only 30% of them actually are, of the people who think they're eights actually are. I mean, it's the biggest disparity is in eight. People want to be eights.
Men
want to be eights, yeah. Women don't want to be eights. We have a daughter-in-law we're quite certain is an eight, and she's just having a terrible time. And my sister, who works in California and is very involved in the anti-grab movement in the Berkeley Bay Area, says that there are support groups for women eights.
I'm interested in your comment, and I don't remember if you said it was your theory or if you got it from somewhere else about where the
how it happens.
Yeah. And we're talking about birth.
Right.
Is that your?
Well, there are some people who say that. Riso, interestingly enough, in all of his earlier books, blamed parenting. And that was a really hard thing for me to swallow, because we had two kids who were nines, and he went on, it goes at great length describing how nines as children weren't loved. Well, I'm sorry. I tried, you know. I really did love them. And that was just hard, you know, and I don't know, I can't remember what was the one thing? Well, that you didn't identify with either parent.
No, it was negative toward father. Oh. Uh-oh.
Yeah, that happens for quite a few years.
Right? Yeah, we're working it out.
We're still working on that one. Right.
But all of the other Enneagram theorists argued with him and said that people respond to their parenting differently because of who they are. And finally, in one of his last, this was just in the last year, he, at a conference, did all of his mea culpas, and he said that because he's a four, and fours love to be victims, and love that stance, that sort of sweet, melancholic stance of victimhood, that he wanted to blame somebody. And, you know, there's the statement that all of our theologies are autobiography and all of our philosophies are autobiography and so on. And he, with all of his knowledge and all of his understanding, couldn't get out of himself enough to realize that his theory was based on his own need to blame somebody, his parents, for who he was. But he now says that it's either genetic. Most people think that the type is genetic and that the wound happens either in the birth process or the first time a baby cries and the mother isn't just instantly there and they realize that they, you know, whatever it is, that instant gratification isn't going to happen for the rest of your life.
Everybody's wounded.
So
it's
blame her.
I got to tell you, it's so interesting because what I'm thinking is, first of all, I've birthed three children.
Right.
Second of all, I'm a labor and delivery nurse.
Yes.
But I have one of my sons, if I may just interject a personal story,
yes,
who I consider myself least close to of all of my children for what reason. I have kiddingly blamed it on the fact that when he was born, he was taken immediately from me. I never even touched him, 10 feet away, and circumcised. I don't ever remember giving them permission to do that, but you know how you forget stuff. And I've always said, I wonder if that's why Rob and I just don't relate to each other, because I let them take him from me.
Theories come and theories go. But
that's such an interesting, when you said that, I thought, why would I be careful how I handle those babies?
There's nothing you can do about it. That the very fact of being shoved brutally out of this absolutely idyllic, instant gratification heaven.
The other piece of that is who decided that's how babies would be born.
Should we blame God?
Yeah.
I'm not blaming, but I've often said, you know, after all of these thousands of years that women have had babies, wouldn't you think that man could have thought of an easier way and a better way as far as pain and, I mean, sure, they have thought of ways, but I mean, like men trying it or?
No thanks.
Whatever.
No thanks. Yeah, I think we can get caught up with where does this begin?
Right.
But the fact that we're all wounded, and that the Enneagram system really doesn't really know for sure, and so the Enneagram system focus is on what we can become as we begin to understand who we are as person, that image of God which is in us. And how that brokenness has, how we have distorted that image, knowingly or unknowingly. This fearlessness is really unknown to us. And so that to get involved in this mystery is really a very fascinating journey.
Do you ever change numbers?
Theoretically, no. No. A week from now, we're going to talk about parenting, and we'll talk about how careful you need to be in labeling your kids, because kids can look in a variety of ways. I have one kid that I would have said in a million years was a one growing up, who turns out to be a seven, but she grew up because, for a variety of reasons, we've had a rather hectic child-rearing process. Do we need to explain that? It wasn't her. No. She was the one that gave me life and joy for all the hard years.
Details of that news at 11.
Yes. But that she lived, as we're going to talk about, in her stress point. So that she looked like a one, but she was really a seven. And once she got out of the stressfulness of our home and was able to kind of become who she was, she kind of floated into this sevenness. I wanted to run through, we have just a few minutes left, and I want to run through something that is, I think, sort of interesting as a part of this whole theoretical framework. The idea is that at this point of wound, whenever it happens and however it happens, at the point of wound, different types react to it in different ways. And that the one reacts to it as separation, and that the reason for the separation is there's something wrong with me. So the one at some core place feels defective. Now, they've been given the gift of wholeness and the vision of completion, but their core false belief is that somehow they're defective. And so they're caught in that paradox. They're caught in the tension of the gift and this core false belief that they are defective. And they spend their whole lives trying to prove they're not defective somehow, by covering it up, whatever. Twos react to this whatever, that first time that they are hurt or ungratified, with a sense of rejection. They feel rejected, and they believe that rejection happens because they're worthless. That their needs are not important, that they're worthless. And so they need to spend the rest of their lives giving value to other people. You know, your needs are more important than mine. I don't have needs because I'm worthless, so I will help you. And if I help you, then maybe you will take care of me. Maybe you'll need me. And maybe I'll be important. But really, I know I'm worthless. Threes react also to this as rejection. And they think that they've been rejected because they were unable to do something, that they were inadequate, that they were just unable to do. And they spend their whole lives trying to prove that that isn't true by doing. So that they're incompetent or inadequate is their core false belief. The fours also experiences is rejection, and it comes out of a core false belief that they are absolutely inadequate and common. And they spend their whole lives trying to prove they're not, that they're unique and special, because the core false belief is that they're ordinary and common. Fives experience this birth or this wound as abandonment. And they think they're abandoned because they really are nothing, that they really are unimportant, that they don't exist. That's the core false belief of a five, that they really don't exist. So they think that if they can acquire knowledge, if they can bring something into themselves, that there will be something, that they will exist, if they could just bring in enough knowledge, fill themselves up with this knowledge, that they will exist, they'll be a person. And so they spend their lives doing that. The sixes also respond to this separation to this wound as abandonment. And their core false belief is that they are, in fact, alone in the world. That existential aloneness is a sixth stance. That I am alone, I will always be alone, people will leave me. And so they spend their lives trying to position themselves within systems, position themselves in institutions or businesses or the church or wherever, so that they won't be alone. Because their core false belief is that they are alone. Sevens, with their core problem of gluttony, they have three core false beliefs instead of just one. They too react as if they were abandoned. And they believe that they were abandoned because they're incomplete, there's something missing, and they're not enough. And that deep, pervasive sense of being not enough. And I therefore need to do more. I need to write more books. I need to know more things. I need to get more things. I need to go more places. I'm not enough. I'll never have enough. I need to just keep trying to figure it out and get more and get more and get more. It's that kind of response to it. Eights believe that this happens because they were powerless, that they could not stop it from happening, that they are at their very core weak, ineffective, and powerless people. And so, of course, they come on as gangbusters and spend their life proving that they're strong, proving that they're indomitable. And that's the defense against the core false belief. And nines, these dear people who are so wonderful to have around, believe at their very core that they're unlovable, that they were separated from their mother because they're not lovable. And they spend their whole lives being agreeable and pleasant and going along and hoping people will like them, but their belief is that they're unlovable. So, you know, it all makes sense in a sort of sad way. And the wonder of the system, I think, is that it joins us all in a very in a common gift and a common wound. I mean, that we all are gifted and we all are wounded. And to be able to see people through that lens makes you much more sympathetic, much more understanding, much more just willing to put up with the whole patheticness of the human species, you know. And there's something kind of nice about that. You know, you can quit carrying your pretenses around and just begin to be honest about who you are and what you are. I think that's quite enough for today. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the...
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about the history of the anagram, that its roots are not a not an awful lot is known about its ancient roots. We'll deal with that a little bit, and then the development really of the anagram body of knowledge really from the 1950s on. And so we'll give a little bit of a historical perspective. And then we'll also engage in a little bit of theological reflection in terms of the gifts and the shadow self. So we'll enlarge what we've begun talking about today. This week, basically, we're talking about the anagram and looking at ourselves. And hopefully by the end of the week, there will be some people will begin to get a sense of where they might be. And they need to then, you need to then probe that and see where that takes you. And then next week, especially for staff here, we're going to talk about the anagram and what that means for our relationships, for our work relationships, our love relationships, parenting relationships, all of those. What?
I'll stay here another week.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So we'll try to lift up some of the dynamics of the interaction or the way the various nine personality types work. And you know, no one is a pure personality type. It's kind of nice to know that we're all impure, isn't it? And Thursday this week we'll talk about how we are impacted by some of the other types who are close to us or that we go to in help or in lack of help. So.
Go in peace.
Serve the Lord.